I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Finley.
I'm Jonathan Green.
Good morning. It is 9/11, Wednesday, June 2nd. This is the TDN Writers' Room, presented by J.P. Morgan Private Bank. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. And after the Nets flushed Bills Celtics out of the playoffs last night, got me thinking, which one of us would be which one in the big three?
Now, how about the Celtics, though? Who would be Kyrie Irving? Do we want to tackle that? That would be really difficult. Hi, I'm Bill Finley. I am the New England Bureau Chief for the Thoroughbred Daily News.
Jonathan Green, General Manager of DJ Stable. And a special shout out to our friend Brian DiDonato, who not only got married this weekend, but also won a race an hour before he walked down the aisle. If that's not commitment on both sides to his wife and to the industry, I don't know what is.
Yeah, shout out to Brian and Rachel, who also works for the TDN, and he's admitted that she's a saint for putting up with his horse stuff. That was like an interesting convergence on their wedding day. So congrats to you guys. We're really happy for you. And the answer to the question that I posed at the beginning, by the way, is I would be all three of the big three because I'm the only one who plays basketball. The TDN Writers' Room is brought to you by the J.P. Morgan Private Bank. The J.P. Morgan Private Bank is a proud sponsor of the Writers' Room. For over 200 years, we've helped successful individuals and families achieve their unique ambitions. To learn more about us and explore becoming a client, visit privatebank.jpmorgan.com. All right, so we had a lot of big racing this weekend. It's always a good time on Memorial Day weekend, although not as good of a time as when the Met Mile used to be run on Memorial Day. It's a pet peeve of mine that I'll bring up every single year, even if nobody wants to hear it. And it was a little bit of a bummer. All those Belmont Stakes over the weekend came off the turf. We had a torrential weekend and very cold here in the city, but it looks like it's warming up and it's going to be nice from here on out. The biggest action was at Santa Anita. We had three grade one races on Monday, the Shoemaker Mile, the Hollywood Gold Cup, and the Gamely. Now, the Shoemaker Mile, I want to give a hat tip to Smooth Like Straight, who got his grade one win, and Michael McCarthy, friend of the show, who was on with us a couple weeks ago, gets another grade one winner. He's a horse that had been knocking at the door at grade one at the grade one level for the last year or so, and finally got his grade one win. So definitely well-earned there. In the Gamely, we had an upset. Maxim Raid, who I thought was a big overlay, at 13-1, won the Gamely. But the biggest, most impactful race of the three was Country Grammar winning the Hollywood Gold Cup. And another, just a tidbit, I'm glad that they changed that name back to the Hollywood Gold Cup instead of the Gold Cup at Santa Anita. It's good to honor Hollywood Park, even though it's no longer with us. So Country Grammar won that race. He got a 106 buyer. He battled back in the stretch to beat Royal Ship, who looks like another pretty nice handicap horse. And those two, I think, are pretty much top of the class in California. I think with them and Mystic Guide, we might have an interesting summer this year in the handicap division. But the thing that struck me about the Gold Cup is, you know, it's hard to get excited about horses like that and performances like that with Bob Baffert as the trainer, at least for me. I think it's kind of, the Derby has kind of put a stain on everything that he does, at least for the near future. And especially with Country Grammar, because, and I'm, don't sue me, I'm not suggesting there's anything untoward going on, but he is a new horse for Bob Baffert. He was a pretty good kind of grade three level horse for Chad Brown last year and last summer. But he's an entirely new horse, and he shows a lot more speed now. He chased a 22:47 pace in that race, going a mile and a quarter. And you know, he's obviously a very nice horse, but it was, I don't know if you guys feel the same way, that it kind of taints a little bit these big performances by these Bob Baffert horses. Especially when you're moving a horse forward like that off of Chad Brown, who's one of the best horses in the game. Now, he didn't run for a while from 3 to 4. So obviously you would factor in some improvement from the horse being a 3-year-old to a 4-year-old. But he's, you know, he is a new horse for Bob Baffert, and it kind of, it's hard for me to enjoy those kind of performances as much as I should. I'm wondering if you guys have any thoughts on that or the rest of the Santa Anita action.
Well, I'm going to take the conversation in another direction, John. And by the way, I agree with everything you said about Country Grammar. But I want to ask John a question, or both of you guys. Something that was really astounding. The horse won the Peter Pan last year and then was subsequently sold at a Keeneland's Horses Racing Age sale. How the heck did he get away for $110,000? John Green, that's nuts, isn't it?
It really is, and shame on me in the end, you know, because we scoured that entire sale and didn't come up with that horse, and shame on a lot of people, because in this day and age, you know, $100,000+ for a Peter Pan winner isn't a lot of money. Now, if I remember correctly, there was a questionable vet issue, which is why the horse was out for such a long time, you know, from August until April. And not that that's the be all and end all, because horses run all the time with questionable, you know, vet issues. And you go to a sale, and I know this is a big bone of contention for a lot of the yearling and 2 year old consigners, is that the intensity that the vets have as far as the scrutiny involved and the x-rays and the scoping, and is it a, you know, are the vets looking to kind of cover their ass and show you every pimple that the horse has, or, you know, are there vets out there that can kind of, you know, give you an analysis of the report and say, yeah, the horse has got XYZ injury, but really, you know, it's not going to be a big deal, especially if he's gotten to this point. So the point I'm making is, yeah, Country Grammar, excuse me, got through the wickets on a lot of people, and has done very, very well since going out to California. But anyway, Bill, I don't want to steal any more time.
Well, thanks for answering that. I, you know, not being a bloodstock guy, I was kind of confused about that. So again, I'm going to kind of take it another direction. I thought one of the biggest stories of the weekend, and it's a big story seemingly every weekend, was field size. Especially for the dirt races, it was absolutely pathetic. And, you know, I don't want to pick on Santa Anita. They do a great job. They're kind of caught between a rock and a hard place as they're out on an island. You don't have like horses at a training center to come in or horses to ship in from other places. But take a look at the Saturday stakes at Santa Anita. Daytona, 5 horses. The Charlie Whittingham, 4 horses. Those are grass races too, by the way. The Triple Bend, 5. It only got a little bit better on the Big Monday. The Shoemaker Mile, 6. The Hollywood Gold Cup, 7, the Gamely, 7, and the Summertime Oaks, 4 horses. And, you know, this is, I don't have the answers to this, but this is not okay. You know, this is a problem that racing has had for a long time. It's getting worse and worse and worse all the time. You know, you can't, nobody wants to bet on this stuff. And it's really bad. You put out a product where you have small fields. The people don't like that. They're not going to bet on it. And, you know, where does this all stop, or how do we fix this? I mean, obviously the solution is less racing, but that's not going to happen either. So, you know, but this, I think this points out again, what a serious problem this is for the sport.
And Bill, I think that you're exactly right. Santa Anita recognized this, which is why they implemented a bonus opportunity for people. If they have a horse that's run outside of California and they ship in for the summer meet, you get extra bonus money. You can run for extra money. You get some travel expenses for the horses as well. So I think they are trying to address it, because you're right. They're out on an island, not literally, but, you know, physically, not physically, I mean, but, you know, but they're, you know, they're kind of their own entity. And we've railed about this for the entire length of the show, about, you know, why they have small fields, how these races are staying at the graded levels that they are when it's a 4 or 5 horse field. And especially when you look at this weekend coming up at Belmont, and you look at the rich races that are there. I mean, rich not only in dollars, but also in length of fields and depth of fields. I think there were two, we're going to get into this later, but there was one race where there's 4 grade 1 winners, and there's another race where there's 5 grade 1 winners. And both fields are double digits. So, you know, there are top horses out there, just they're not migrating west. So I don't know if we need to have another gold rush, or we need to have another, you know, some kind of bonus incentivization. But I think that some of the, you know, some of the entities and powers that be are trying to address this. I wanted to talk a little bit more about Smooth Like Straight, because not only was that race an impressive one in my eyes, and the horse, you know, ran a lifetime best, you know, buyer as well off Lasix. But how about the fact that Smooth Like Straight is the son of Midnight Loot? And Midnight Loot is probably one of the dollar for dollar best horse values as a stallion. I mean, he throws meat and potatoes kind of horses. It looks like every time you look at a weekend card, there's a Midnight Loot in one of the races coming up. I know there's a filly running this weekend that was in one of the top races, obviously Smooth Like Straight. And it just, you know, we forget sometimes in the industry, because we talk about the Tappets and the into Mischiefs and all the great bred horses that are out there, that there are sires like Midnight Loot and The Factor and McLean's Music, you know, that are just really, really, they throw every year, they throw like 2 or 3 really solid top horses, and they're standing for $10,000 to $15,000.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely is an underrated sire. There are a couple of horses like that that I think don't get the credit they should. Looking at Lucky, I think, is another one at Coolmore. And also, Tonalist got his first grade one winner with Country Grammar. And he was always a horse that I thought, you know, his progeny would obviously get better going longer. But there are so few chances to run, you know, mile and a quarter plus in this country that I think, you know, he's not necessarily best represented by the current racing landscape, but that was a pretty big accomplishment for him because he got overlooked a little bit. He was in that star-studded stallion class from a couple of years ago. And Liam's Map has also really done a great job at Lane's End. And he had a rising star the other day named Bo Liam, who I wanted to talk about a little bit. At Churchill, he was one of two rising stars on Saturday. Both of them were extremely impressive in different ways. Bo Liam ran six furlongs and was up on the pace and just exploded away in the stretch and ran 108.3, which is, you know, not a time you see a lot at Churchill outside of like top stakes races. And he crushed that field. So he's trained by Steve Asmussen for Stone Street. So he's a very interesting horse going forward. And those Liam's Maps can really run. And he's another one that maybe got overlooked a little bit in that class with American Pharoah and Constitution, but you know, his horses can really, really run. And on turf, too. We're going to see Colonel Liam again this Saturday in the Manhattan. And we're going to get to those previews a little bit later. The other rising star on Saturday was for friend of the show, West Point, and a couple other no-name owners. Just kidding. Very star-studded ownership group there for First Captain. He cost $1.5 million as a yearling. And he won first out and was a really impressive winner first out. He didn't win by a lot, but if you watch his debut race, he looked beaten at the eighth pole. He was like six or seven lengths back and just flew late to get up going seven furlongs, stretched out to a mile on Saturday on a sloppy track. And he showed a lot of guts in addition to his talent. He sat up on the pace, put away the pace setter, and he got passed and bumped in mid-stretch by a horse named Hometown, who's an okay horse for Chad Brown. And he got interfered with and like almost sent into the rail and got kind of blown by in mid-stretch and battled back at the inside and ended up winning going away in that race. And that was enough to earn the Rising Star nod. And he's a very exciting horse for West Point. Three-year-old, he's, you know, we'll see where he ends up next. You got to think that he's going to be a candidate for the Travers. You know, he needs two turns. I think he's eventually going to be better doing that. But he's a super interesting horse as well. I just wanted to run down some of the other action from this past weekend. It was affected a lot by the rain. You know, the Penn Mile card came off the turf, unfortunately, on Friday night. So that was a little bit of a bummer. But Churchill in the Matt Wynn, Folsom is another horse who's throwing his hat into the ring for the top three-year-old discussion. He was a horse that spent the first part of his career, first three or four starts on turf, and then switched to the dirt in a race at Keeneland. It was an off-the-turf race. They ended up winning, and that he kind of found his new home in that way because then he won the Oaklawn Stakes, and then he won the Matt Wynn the other day. And just – it was an incredible performance because the pace was relatively soft and he was well off of it. And he just exploded away in the stretch. If you look at his final come home time, he came home in like 29 and change for his final 5/16. So that's kind of unheard of on dirt going two turns. Also Gam's Mission. I want to shout out Sherry DeVoe, who got her first stakes win in the Regret on Saturday. A couple other pretty nice performances. Set Piece also for Brad Cox got a 100 buyer and winning the Douglas Park. En Voutant for Ken McPeak got a 99 buyer in winning the Shawnee Stakes. And then I just wanted to mention a horse at Lone Star as well before I wrap up this. A horse named Warrant, who won the Texas Derby. And he only got a 90 buyer, but he was super wide on both turns and was really determined to win that race. And he was also coming out of the Oaklawn Stakes. So the 1-2 finishers from that race both came back to win stakes over this past weekend. And it just, you know, we're going to learn more, I think, this Saturday. But some of those performances really made me think about how wide open this three-year-old division is. And the possibility that maybe the horse that's going to be three-year-old champion hasn't run, you know, in a graded stake yet, or hasn't run in a grade one race yet, because there are just there's so many horses who could potentially be on that stage and get that trophy at the end of the year that it's going to make for an exciting second half of the year. And just to tie it into Bill's point about short fields, and I agree with him that it is a big problem. Even at Belmont this weekend, I think there are too many 6 and 7 horse fields. But I think with the wide open nature of the 3-year-old division, I think you're going to get a lot of big fields the rest of the year. This week's 8-horse Belmont Stakes notwithstanding. Any other thoughts from you guys on the weekend?
Yeah, real quick, just to mention, I like First Captain was really good. I would imagine, I don't know this for a fact, but I would think it'd be pretty logical that you go back next to the Dwyer. So maybe we'll see him Dwyer, Jim Dandy, Travers. Shug's a real New York guy, so I don't think he would ship that horse to the Haskell. We'll wait and see. But again, we like to stir up the you-know-what on this show. It's things we do. So I think one of the races you didn't mention, Joe, was the Summertime Oaks, the winner Phoenix Thoroughbreds. Now, what's the guy's name? I'm sorry, I can't pronounce it, but you know who I'm talking about. The head of Phoenix Thoroughbreds, allegedly in a money laundering scheme. His stable's been banned in France. His stable's been banned in England. In Australia, he hasn't been banned per se, but they're withholding paying him any purse money. The United States, the racing commissions or whatnot, just seem to say, meh, so what, go on and run. Now, this is an integrity issue. It's not an integrity issue like Service Navarro or even the Baffert Positives. But nonetheless, American horse racing, give this guy carte blanche to go do whatever he wants, considering all the trouble he's in.
Yeah, I mean, that's crazy. The guy's name is Amer Abdulaziz, by the way, and he was allegedly involved in a money laundering scheme with like some sham cryptocurrency. The crypto world is very shady. And I know there's some people making money, but there's a lot of unregulated nonsense going on in that world. I thought about that too. Whenever I see those silks, I think this doesn't look great that American racing is still letting this guy, you know, buy and race top horses. And, you know, I don't know. It's one of those things where, you know, 5,000 different racing jurisdictions have to make an individual decision based on whether or not they want to let this guy run. Whereas overseas, you have that centralized body that can say he's not going to run anywhere in this country or in this continent even. And he doesn't face that kind of scrutiny in America because no one cares. Right. No one cares. And even if they did care, they don't have the wherewithal to be able to do something about it. Go ahead, Jeff.
Well, and I probably, you know, out of the three of us, I tweet probably in the middle. Joe, you tweet every time you take a bowel movement. And Bill, I don't think I've ever seen a tweet by you. And I'm kind of in the middle of the big three. But basically, you know, I was so like surprised and outraged that not that the horse won, because the horse is a legitimate horse. But that they were able to race the horse. Phoenix Thoroughbred still has a license. And I even looked up the national licensing form, the application for owners. And there's a plethora of questions there. But there's two questions on there that really made me shake my head. One is, are there any criminal charges or complaints pending against you or your spouse? That's a yes. And are there any outstanding court imposed civil judgments against you? That also is a yes. So either they didn't fill out the application truthfully, which is, you know, which is against the rules and regulations, or they did, and the California Racing Association or whatever the powers that be that makes the decision as to who would get a license never followed up on it. But either way, there's got to be something wrong with this process, because either the guy committed fraud by filling out the application, you know, incorrectly, or the regulators that were supposed to be following up on this never looked at it. And I understand, like, if Joe Smith comes in and fills out an application for an owner's license, they may not look it up because they don't know from Joe Smith. But this guy is so unique, you know, in his history and also, you know, in what's been going on, that as soon as they got the application, somebody should have been like, where do I know this name from? Was he a guest on the TDN show? No. Was he, you know, was he running for office? No. Oh, it's that crypto, you know, currency fiasco that's going on. Oh, you know what? Let's let another Ponzi schemer allegedly come into our business, come in and buy horses and then run and win graded stake races and embarrass us more.
Right. And then the industry likes to, act shocked and appalled when there's like a terrible scandal story that makes national news about the business. And it's like, we set ourselves up for this kind of stuff by just looking the other way on so many things. And yeah, it was just, I don't want to be too negative because it was a really good weekend of racing and we got the Belmont coming up. But yeah, over the weekend, like watching Baffert win the Gold Cup and watching the Phoenix Thoroughbred Silks streak past the post in that four horse field in the summertime Oaks. It's tough to feel good about stuff like that. It's just, you gotta be honest.
And I feel bad because Kenny McPeak's a good guy. The trainer is a good guy. And we've had him on the show and he's a friend of the show. And he really, he does a lot of good things for the industry. I think he tries to do the right thing for the industry, given his mantle as one of the top trainers. And I think that I can't speak for him. I did not have a conversation with him about this, but I'm sure it's kind of like bittersweet. Like, the horse won and I won another big race and I'll get, paid for it. But man, it's just got to leave a bad taste in your mouth when you win a race like that. And for people who allegedly are doing these issues.
Yeah. And I don't there's an argument to be made about whether or not it's Ken McPeak's responsibility to not train for guys like that. I think you could say, yeah, he probably should tell him to get lost. But at the same time, there's only so many owners in the game. And there is, it shouldn't be in his hands. It shouldn't be in the individual trainer's hands to be like, I'm not going to train for this guy. It should be racing should take care of it at a level above him. Mm-hmm. And we just never do.
Yep.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland, home of the world's yearling sale. Make plans to attend Keeneland's September yearling sale beginning Monday, September 13th. You can learn more at theworldsyearlingsale.com. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
The World's Yearling Sale. Make plans for the Keeneland September yearling sale, September 13th through the 25th. Visit theworldsyearlingsale.com to learn more.
Owning a multiple graded stakes winning racehorse like Decorated Invader or a TDN Rising Star like First Captain is attainable with a racing partnership with West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for a less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and your chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. So we said we were going to follow up on this this week after we talked about it last week, the Monmouth anti-whip experiment. Bill touched on this in his week in review, and I'm going to let him talk about it mostly because he wants to pat himself on the back about it. He said that there weren't that many changes or differences noticeable in the first couple of days of racing at Monmouth. I'm going to let him explain what he means by that, and then John and I can respond.
All right. Well, here's what happened. Nothing. Let's move on. Let's talk about the Belmont. But that nothing happened is a story, as we know, because, all these Chicken Little, the sky is falling scenarios that we heard from everybody, included all sorts of really, troubling aspects of what could go wrong, what will go wrong with this. So, let's look at the various aspects of the racing. Was it safe? Yes. There was no spills. There was no incidents. There was nothing anywhere close to an accident. Not only that, the whole thing was some of the jockeys not even carrying a whip. That registered with me. If the whip is so important, you're allowed to carry the whip for safety reasons. Why would these guys not even choose to use it? And the reason why is they didn't want to get fined. And they didn't want to just have a mind cramp and then go back and hit the horse and get fined and suspended for 5 days. The racing was very formful. As a matter of fact, it was way too formal. It was dominated by favorites. Now, the other thing we have to look at is the handle. Now, so it passed 2, 3, 4 tests this weekend. There's a lot more to go. But if the handle is going to be off, 30, 40% at Monmouth, that's not good. And it would, lead you to believe that the whip is something that the bettors say they want to see, and they are staying away from it. So the handle was bad, but it had to be with, of course it was bad. There are 4 and 5 horse races all weekend on the slop, 3 to 5 favorites, no races on the grass. So I don't think you can judge the handle off this weekend. Last weekend, this weekend coming up will be a lot more important. We'll see what the handle is. And if it's back to the, normal levels at Monmouth, then, really all the arguments people were making about why this is such a bad idea, well, everyone pretty much fell flat on their face.
And Bill, I'm glad that you said that the real litmus test is going to be in the upcoming weekends, because with all the rain that we had and it wasn't a great card and it wasn't a deep card at any stretch. It really didn't lend itself to be a better's paradise for sure. So I think, you know, I saw some people, you know, trumpeting, you know, how handle was down, everything. And I think it's just not a fair test yet to see. I really would, and I'd be interested in your opinion on this. I really don't know if you can get a fair assessment of it until like Haskell Day, where they have another big racing day where there's going to be, you know, instrumental amounts of money that's going to be wagered on the races or not. I mean, I think on a Friday or Saturday in rainy May and kind of doldrum June, I don't know if it's off, you know, a couple thousand bucks here or there for the pool. I mean, that's not really a big, you know, litmus test for us, but I'd be curious to see once we get to the Haskell, how things play out, especially with some riders coming in from out of town that are kind of bigger than Monmouth. I mean, no offense to the Monmouth pool of jockeys right now, but a lot of them, even if they didn't agree with the rule, had to buckle under and either not whip the horse or not even bring the whip just because they can't afford to get penalized or suspended the way they are. But, you know, for the Haskell weekend, when you start getting some of these top riders come in, I'd be very interested to hear what their take is going to be. What Johnny Velasquez has obviously been very outspoken, but what some of these other top riders from around the country are going to be saying when they come out of the jocks room and they're either told, you know, remember, you can't whip the horse or not even bring a whip out at all.
Yeah, John, yeah. A couple of things. I'm sorry, Joe. First of all, John Velasquez has said he will not ride at Monmouth. Now, the only opportunity to do so would be the Haskell. So if, you know, who would he be riding? Does Medina Spirit jump back up and go into the Haskell for Baffert? Would Velasquez really stick to that? He's very solid in his belief. So I see no reason why he would go back on that, but we'll have to see that. And the other part, one thing I forgot too, is that, and I want a couple points I want to make, so excuse me for jumping all over. The other thing that happened over the weekend was that all the jockeys said, we're not going to ride, we're not going to ride, we're not going to ride, we're unified, this is a horrible rule. Then lo and behold, everybody rode. Two guys out of the entire colony, Gallardo and Joe Bravo, decided not to ride. So, I mean, that was a pretty piss poor showing so far as unity. I know they're not officially a union, but, you know, the jockeys didn't stick together, and that doesn't speak well for them. Now, John, I definitely want to disagree with you. You don't need to wait for the Haskell for the handle. All you need is apples to apples comparisons because, first of all, you can't do 2020 because, first thing, they didn't run in May and June in 2020, and then COVID messes everything up. So the best way to do it is compare with numbers from 2019. So suppose this Saturday coming up, what will that be, June 6th, 7th, something like that. If the handle is $4 million, and there's every reason to believe that it's an apples to apples comparison to the same day in June in 2019. And the handle was 2019 was 5 million. Oh, they're off a million in a fair comparison. That would be a very bad sign. We'll know soon enough. We won't have to wait for the Haskell. Just need to get some dates where you can compare. You know, you can't have sloppy off the turf four horse fields versus a day when they had, you know, 12, 13 races and 9, 10 horses in a race around the grass. It's going to happen soon enough. We'll know well before the Haskell.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is that, you know, I agree with most of Bill's points in his story, but I felt like you kind of dismissed the handle drop off just because of the off track. And obviously that's a factor, but I don't know, anecdotally, I don't feel like that affects Belmont as much when they're off turf races. I think that needs to be studied more, and we're going to get more information this weekend to see whether or not handle really has fallen off a cliff at Monmouth. And if so, I think you need to, you know, reevaluate your position on this. The main thing is that there were no safety issues. There were no horses that, you know, bore out and couldn't be controlled, and there were no like pile ups or anything. That's the main thing, is whether or not there are going to be safety issues. The point that you made that's interesting is the jockeys not carrying the whips out to the track. That part is interesting because, you know, that does, you know, go fly in the face of people like me and some other people who say that it's not safe for the jockeys to have no corrective tool. I mean, if they're going to go out to the track without one, I don't know whether they were trying to make a statement or what, then that kind of contradicts that belief. It's going to be interesting to see how the rest of the meet goes. And, you know, you talked about there were only two guys that were that boycotted the opening day. Those are the two biggest riders they have, you know, just to be fair. This Joe Bravo and Antonio Gallardo pretty much, other than Paco, dominate that meet. So that was, even though most of the jockeys did ride. I thought that that was interesting, that the two guys who I guess have the most, you know, the most to fall back on in their careers did not decide to ride at Monmouth. But, you know, I think it's too early to draw conclusions. I think there were only, you know, a few dozen races over the weekend at Monmouth. But I'm open to it. I'm going to watch and I'm going to see how the rest of this meet goes. I'm not betting it now. I'm just not going to do it. I'm not going to bet something that I think is so unorthodox and such an outlier from the rest of the racing world, at least here in America. So I'm not going to bet it yet, but I'm open to seeing new data and changing my mind, because, you know, that's, you have to do that as an analyst and as a horse player. So we'll see. We'll see what the rest of the meet looks like. But yeah, so far opening weekend, thankfully no safety issues. But I think the handle needs a lot more study, because I think it's an easy excuse to say, well, handle was off because, you know, the races were off the turf, when I think that other tracks don't really have that steep of a drop off when the races come off the turf. Go ahead, John.
Yeah. And Bill, one of the other things that I think maybe we need to include in this calculus is that at the end of the meet in 2019, all of the owners received a notification from management at Monmouth Park saying that I don't remember the exact wording, I'm paraphrasing, but basically, because of the relationship they have now with the sports book, that owners of racehorses were not allowed to bet on races at Monmouth Park. Now, I don't bet a lot anyway, so it doesn't affect me that much. But, you know, Bill, you're there more often and talking to people who are betting in the big rooms. You know, would that affect handle if owners actually, you know, listen to that proclamation by Monmouth's management and not bet on horses?
No, I mean, I guess it could a little bit. But then again, you know, you said at the end of the 2019 meet. That might affected a little bit, but I got to think that if you're Joe horse owner and you really want to bet your horse, you send your neighbor Harry from down the street. Just, Harry, can you go up to the windows and bet for me? You know, how easy would it be to ignore an edict like that? So, you know, that could affect it a little bit. And I know what Joe's saying. You know, the handle, look, I'm the first to admit the handle was not good, but all I'm saying is let's wait till we have a fair comparison. If it's off 25-30% this weekend, I will say you're right. You know, this is affecting people's betting habits. I in the long run, I don't think it really will. And the other thing I'll say is, you know, let's just table this discussion. And I've said this all along, you know, by the end of October, when Monmouth is done running, this won't even be anything that anybody's talking about. It'll just be, this is the way. It's like Woodbine. Everybody screamed and screamed and screamed, you can't do this, you can't do this. No one pays any attention or ever talks now about Woodbine has very restrictive whipping rules. By the, you know, already it's died down from the first weekend. You know, you only have 1 million hysterical people on Twitter yelling about it instead of 10 million hysterical people on Twitter yelling about it. And at the end of next week, it's going to be down to 500,000. And by the end of the week, it'll only be Joe Bianca under a false name saying what a terrible rule this is.
Challenge accepted, Bill Finley.
You got it. Yes.
I will be like Kevin Durant and create burner accounts just to tell Bill about this for sure. This is one of the situations where it's good that Bill isn't on Twitter, because I've seen some of the reports. They're very not nice, but Bill's above it all, up in his perch. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
This week's TDN Story of the Week is brought to you by the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project. Find out how you can get involved in racehorse ownership this summer at Canterbury Park with several options and investments ranging from $250 to $10,000. Visit racehorseminnesota.com to learn more. So the story of the week this week is Belmont Stakes Week at the Belmont Racing Festival. It's going to be an incredible 3 days of racing. We're going to get to the Belmont Stakes and the Saturday card in a second, but I just wanted to run down the Thursday and Friday action. First, there's actually an interesting allowance race early on tomorrow's card, on Thursday's card at Belmont, that I think people should be paying attention to. Following C, who was one of the horses that Spendthrift took away from Bob Baffert after the whole Medina Spirit thing. He was named a TDN Rising Star in his second start at Oaklawn. He's going to make his first start for Todd Pletcher in an allowance tomorrow early on the card. And reinvestment risk is in there as well. He was runner-up to Jackie's Warrior in both the Champagne and the Hopeful. He's going to make his three-year-old debut. So that's a race early on the card that I think is worth paying attention to. Later in the card, there's three stakes, two graded stakes. The Intercontinental and the Wonder Again are grade threes. And the Astoria, which is for two-year-old fillies. Wesley Ward has a very nice horse, I think, in that race named Happy Soul, who I think is going to do a lot of damage this summer if she can stay together. And then the Intercontinental and the Wonder Again. Intercontinental's got a decent little field. It's no superstars in there, but a nice enough betting race. The Wonder Again, I think, is really interesting and has a handful of really nice horses. Gift List, who I'm a big fan of, was probably my only good opinion on Derby weekend. She's going to be in there along with Jouster, who she ran second to in Appalachian. Technical Analysis, who's a Chad Brown Rising Star, is going to be in there. And Plum Ali, who's a very nice 2-year-old filly on the grass, is going to make her second start as a 3-year-old. So those races are definitely worth looking at on Thursday. As far as Friday, there's four graded stakes races. There's two grade twos, the True North and the New York Stakes. And then three grade twos, the Belmont Gold Cup, the 2-mile Belmont Gold Cup, also a grade two race. And then the grade three Better Roses Stakes. My girl Chub Wagon is in the Better Roses Stakes. I'm backing off a little bit on challenging Gamine on behalf of her connections, but we'll see. I still think she's a very nice horse. Belmont Gold Cup in the New York has a lot of international participation, which always makes it interesting. I think Belmont does a good job of attracting the international horses for these turf races. Obviously, they have the Turf Festival later in the summer, but these races, I think, are going to attract a lot of really nice European horses as well. On Saturday, the Just the Game has attracted a couple of nice Euros from Charlie Appleby's barn. One thing about the True North I wanted to mention that's kind of interesting is six of the seven horses are 6 years old and up. So a lot of old timers in the True North. The youngest horse in the race is 5 years old and looking at Bikinis. And then also the Tremont is Friday as well. That's the equivalent of the Astoria. That's for 2-year-old boys on Friday, going 5.5 furlongs. So great first couple of days, a nice little prelude to Saturday's action. And we're going to get into Saturday's action after this break.
It's said that life is simply a series of memories we share with the ones we love. The experiences, the joys, the thrills. Imagine a life that includes meeting your very own racehorse for the first time. The thrill of watching your racehorse passing others one by one down this stretch, and then sharing the winner's circle celebration with those closest to you. Let the Minnesota Racehorse Engagement Project help guide you to the experiences and memories you deserve. Owning a racehorse is less expensive and more attainable than you think. Visit racehorseminnesota.com. That's racehorseminnesota.com. And begin making your memories this summer at Canterbury Park.
Flexibility, convenience, opportunity. Find your digital advantage in the Keeneland Digital Sales Ring. Backed by the most trusted name in thoroughbred sales. Visit KeenelandDigital.com to learn more.
All right, so Saturday is the to me, the biggest card, the best card outside of the Breeders' Cup on the American racing calendar. There's going to be 8 grade one races at Belmont, 9 graded stakes total. We've got the Acorn, the Belmont, the Met Mile, the Jiper, the Just the Game, the Ogden Phipps, the Manhattan, and the Woody Stevens are the grade ones. And then we have the Brooklyn Stakes as well. The stakes action kicks off with the Woody Stevens, which is in the third race on Saturday at Belmont, 12:47 post time. So I'll have to set my alarm, make sure I'm up for that one. Really interesting field, even though there's only 6 horses, ton of speed. Cattle River's in there after deciding that they decided not to go into the Matt Wynn. They're going to cut him back, try to make him a sprinter, which I think makes a lot of sense with his running style. But also Jackie's Warrior and Dream Shaker in there, who just threw down throughout the stretch of the Pat Day Mile. It was absolutely phenomenal. Both horses were phenomenal that day. There's a lot of speed in the race. I think I might set it up for Tulane Trist, for Sherita Vo, see if she can stay hot. And the two races later is the Acorn. You got Obligatory, who won last down the Eight Bells, a 16-1 winner. Travel Column is in there. Day Out of the Office, who I thought ran a monster race in the Eight Bells, was up on a fast pace, made a big early move, and then just got run down late by Obligatory, who I think was a kind of a perfect trip closer. Search Results is in there as well. It was a close runner up in the Kentucky Oaks. And even Make Mischief for Mark Cassie, I think, has a pretty good shot in that race at what could be a decent price. Then we've got the Jiper. You got your usual suspects in there, Bound for Nowhere. Alexandra, who won the Jiper last year, got Stormies in there. So we got a couple of fillies. A lot of horses coming from different directions in there. The Ogden Phipps is very interesting. We got Swiss Skydivers in there, Latruska, no Monomoy Girl. Unfortunately, she had a little bit of a setback, but She Dares the Devil is in there. Bonnie South, who won the Double Dog Dare last time out, and I think is primed to have a big four-year-old campaign. Valiance is in there as well. First start since running second in the Breeders' Cup Distaff. The Just the Game, super interesting, big field. Like I said, we had a couple of Euros in there. Althika and Summer Romance, both for Charlie Appleby and Godolphin, both very interesting horses coming over for that race. And then a horse that I think is super interesting, who was a Euro for Judmont and Chad Brown, named Pocket Square, who ran at Keeneland last month or in April and just dominated his allowance race. Flew home, I think, is potentially a real monster, but that's a super interesting race. I don't think there's one horse that is going to be a heavy favorite. I think it's going to be a great betting race. The Met Mile, even though it's a six horse field, and I wonder where all of these cowardly owners are, six horses for $1 million. You can't find, you know, third and fourth still pay well in that race. You can't, you know, rustle up more than six entries for the Met Mile. Nevertheless, it is a quality field. And the big matchup is going to be Mischievous Alex and Nixco. Now, Nixco is going to make his first start since he kind of did the fade job in the Saudi Cup. But before that, he obviously won the Pegasus World Cup and won the Breeders' Cup Dirt Mile. He's obviously a big time monster and true outside, which I think is a big advantage in this race. Kind of puts the pressure on Mischievous Alex, who's at the rail, to try to figure out a trip. But he's a big time horse. He got a 109 buyer last time. So that's a huge, huge matchup. But it's not just those two. Dr. Post is in there. He looked good in the Westchester, got a 104 buyer. Silver State, who won the Oakland Handicap last out, is pretty interesting. And even by my standards, who's, you know, his form has tailed off a little bit, but he's got back races that at least make him competitive if the pace gets hot. And the Manhattan is a big wide open race as well. It's one of the budding rivalries, I think, is Domestic Spending and Colonel Liam. I think they could clash several times this year. And they obviously dead heated in the Turf Classic at Churchill last time out. And Tribivon, who's another interesting horse, got a 105 buyer last time for Chad Brown, the Fort Marcy. He's in there. Gufo's in there. So that's some of the highlights from the undercard races on Saturday at Belmont. Monster day of racing. Can't wait to just break it all down next week. And I think we're going to see some really explosive performances. So best of luck to everybody who's involved in those races and who's going to be betting those races. It's just, like I said, you really, other than the Breeders' Cup, you really can't top this day of racing. And it looks like we're going to get perfect weather too. I think it's going to be about 80 degrees and sunny. So no worries about off the turf like we had over the past weekend. Wonder if Bill or John have any thoughts on all of that before we get to the Belmont.
Joe, lots of great races, as you mentioned. I also, by the way, totally agree with you on this Met Mile thing. Put it back to Memorial Day. That would be so much better. And, you know, rather than just having some nothing races on Memorial Day. But anyways, let's not talk any more about that. The Ogden Phipps, to me, is the race of the day. You have Swiss Skydiver, Latruska, and She Dares the Devil. And, you know, if you had Monomoy Girl, it's like a superstar race. However, we know where she is. She's injured and she's not going to come back probably until the fall. Swiss Skydiver is the interesting horse to me because, you know, she was so widely appreciated and got so much acclaim, all of it deserved last year. And she comes out this year and she wins the Beholder Mile and then runs a real clunker in the Apple Blossom. It was one of the few starts of her life that she just didn't have it. Runs third beat in 6.5 lengths. Be interesting to see if she can bounce back. Latruska will be interesting to see if she's for real after that narrow and very game win over Monomoy Girl and Swiss Skydiver in the Apple Blossom. And of course, you know, what would a race be without a Brad Cox monster in there? She Dares the Devil in that spot. So, and the other thing that was interesting, and I'm surprised nobody really made a I didn't read too much about this, but yeah, this whole Robbie Alvarado story was a big part of the Swiss Skydiver story. He's won one race all year and was aboard Swiss Skydiver in the Beholder Mile. You know, clearly at this point in his career, how little he's riding, he is not an asset compared to the Ortiz brothers, John Velasquez, Flavian Pratt, whatever. And finally, Kenny McPeak, signed the divorce papers and Jose Ortiz will ride. So, for people who aren't big fans of Alvarado, they'll certainly think that, that Jose Ortiz would be. It's not even speculation or an opinion. It's definitely a favorable jock switch.
This card of racing is equivalent to last night. I went, took my daughter to go get ice cream. And there was like 30 different toppings in the ice cream bar. And I was like, Swedish fish, that'd be good. Cookie dough, that would be better. And I went through the whole thing. Surprise, surprise. I went through the whole thing and was like, ooh. And when I went through this card, it was like, oh, you know, the Acorn looks really good because it's got, you know, six really nice horses in there. A couple of horses that are sprinters trying to go the one turn mile. That one looks pretty good. And ooh, the Woody Stevens, that one looks great. Jackie's Warrior cutting back, you know, taking on Cattle River cutting back. There's, you know, four or five horses here who were legitimately on the Derby campaign and they're all, you know, getting together, in a 7-furlong race. And then you got the two fillies and the Jiper, you know, Alexandra, who won the Jiper last year and got Stormy. And ooh, that looks pretty good. And then you get to Bill, and you mentioned the Ogden Phipps, which is like, oh my God, how is this race going to get any better? It's got four grade one winners in it that are all getting together, for the big race, the Just a Game grade one. And then I got down to the Met Mile with Joe, you mentioned this Mischievous Alex, running against Nixco on opposite ends of the field. And really, I don't think either one of them would prefer to run a mile, but just the way that the race came up, obviously it's called the Met Mile, and it's not necessarily the preferred distance for either horse, but it's a great matchup of two heavyweights, Mischievous Alex being the sprinter trying to go the one turn mile, and Nixco coming in from overseas after a big campaign, last year. I mean, that is a heavyweight match, that we don't see that often. And then you get to the Manhattan, which has five grade one winners, five of them that are all coming together to run a mile and a quarter, for $750,000. I mean, you can't get a better pre-card, than what we have, for Belmont Day. I mean, I even remember as good as the Derby was, with all the races they had a couple of allowance claimers, that were going on. You could have claimed a horse on Derby Day if you wanted to. And Belmont, this day, Belmont Stakes Day, is just chock full of phenomenal races, not only stake races, but grade two, grade one races. And look at all these matchups. You got full fields for some of them. You got four or five grade one winners in some of them. You got head to head races, in a couple of these races. And we haven't even gotten to the Belmont yet. That's how exciting this is.
That's a perfect lead in to the Belmont Stakes. John's a professional, and eight horses will line up for $1.5 million. That's just going to leave that there in a three-year-old division that's dying for a leader. So Central Quality is going to be is pegged as the 2-1 morning line favorite. He's going to break from the two posts. Todd Pletcher has three horses in the race. He's got Bourbonic, he's got Overtook, and Known Agenda. So he's got three of the eight horses in the field. It's going to be interesting to see how the race is ridden. I think it's always a very interesting rider's race because, as much as I love aggressive riding, you can't obviously gun it in a mile and a half race, but you also don't want to be too far back because I don't think there's like a rich history of deep closers winning the Belmont. I think you generally want to be at least up close to the pace. And I think, obviously after what happened in the Derby, I expect Rock Your World to be a hard send, as hard as you could send in a mile and a half race. I think they're going to just definitely try to go for and take the lead. And then behind him, it's going to be interesting how things shake out. Rombauer has kind of a little bit of tactical speed. Essential Quality has tactical speed. I don't expect Luis Saez to be that far off the pace with him. Hot Rod Charlie also was a front runner in the Louisiana Derby. And I think he's going to try to you know, stay out of traffic. I thought it was very interesting. We touched on it before that Flavien Prat got off of Rombauer to ride Hot Rod Charlie. I don't know what that's about, but you rarely ever see that a jockey get off a horse, you know, in a Triple Crown race, unless it's something like Calvin Burrell, where he got off My Dad Bird to ride Rachel Alexandra, who obviously was a complete monster. These horses, I think, are a little more evenly matched, but I think it's a very interesting rider's race. I expect it to be a pretty close finish. I just can't see one of these horses just blowing away the field by 5, 6, 7, 8 lengths. I think it's so evenly matched. I think Essential Quality is a legitimate favorite, but you know, like I kind of feel like I did going into the Derby, where, you know, he's a very nice horse. He shows up every time. He's very tractable, so he can do whatever the jockey wants, but he's not like that far of a cut above the rest of the horses. It's not the kind of horse, even though I respect him, it's not the kind of horse that I'm trying to lean on as a pretty heavy favorite. I think he's probably going to go off at about 8-5 or so. But just some cursory early thoughts from you guys on the Belmont.
Yeah, I think one of two horses is going to win the race. And I got a couple of days to make my pick. The first one is Rock Your World, Joe. You're absolutely right. He is definitely going to go to the front. His Derby was awful. Do we put a line through it or not? Well, you can at least sort of make a case for putting a line through it. I mean, he got banged around at the start when he ran into Essential Quality. Here's a horse that normally wants to be up on the lead, and he was 10th early. It was just, the whole thing was just a disaster. So I think you can probably throw that race out. He runs back to a Santa Anita Derby. I mean, he's got both the talent and the speed to win this. Will he get a lose by 5, 6 lengths? No, but I think it'll be a length and a half, 2 lengths clear of whomever is second going down the backstretch. And then it all depends on what kind of fractions. I mean, if Rosario can slow it down and he gets the half in 49 and change or something like that, he will be very, very tough. The other horse that can win is Essential Quality. And at first, I was a little bit disappointed about his Derby. I thought it was kind of a flat race. Didn't really seem to be running, sort of being in slow motion a little bit in the stretch. But I looked back at the race and a couple times last night, and the race was a little bit better than I thought. First of all, he didn't get wiped out at the start, but he did get banged around with Rock Your World coming out of the gate. That cost him a little bit early. It cost him some positioning. He forced Luis Saez to ride probably a little bit different race than he intended to ride. Then there's the wide factor. According to Trackus, he ran 67 feet further than Medina Spirit. And then what they do is they boil down each horse's performance into the miles per hour that they ran, which takes into account the ground loss. He was, on that statistic, the fastest horse in the race, running 37.8 miles an hour. Obviously, Brad Cox is going to have a horse ready to go off a 5-week layoff. Will he like the mile and a half? I don't see why not. He's by Tappet. He's certainly a main contender. Like I said, I think one of those two horses will win.
And we haven't even touched on two of the horses that ran in the Derby. Hot Rod Charlie, who ran third, who is also a legitimate contender in this race because he does have tactical speed. And Known Agenda, and I know Known Agenda went into the Derby as one of the top three horses, arguably, in the field. And as soon as they pulled the pill that he was, you know, post one, that pretty much, even though Pletcher downplayed it, that pretty much doomed him, for that race. Well, guess what? He ain't in the one hole again. He's all the way, you know, almost on the outside. And I really feel like that there's a bounce back potential for a horse like Known Agenda, who legitimately is a, you know, really good horse, and just was a victim of circumstance of getting, you know, the wrong post position. So he's a horse also that maybe, like Rock Your World, you could draw a line through the Derby and say, this is a horse that has a chance. We didn't even mention Overtook, who was a $1 million purchase, that Todd Pletcher has on, you know, has in the race that blinkers on for the first time. But I think overall, after watching the Derby campaign and a couple of the races in the Triple Crown, I think we can all agree that this would be a very different group of horses if Life Is Good had continued to do what he was doing. I mean, he really, now that we've watched through most of these Derby preps and most of the all the Derby preps and a couple of the Triple Crown races, I think, you know, my attentions continue to steer back to Life Is Good and just how much better he was than this group. And this is coming from somebody that campaigned a horse in a lot of those, preps and the Derby. The other thing that I thought was really interesting, and Bill, you're going to have to correct my history on this, but I read something about this is the first time in 30 something years that a horse has not run in all three Triple Crown races.
Yeah, that's correct. I don't know what the date is, and I didn't come up with the statistics. Someone else did, but I don't remember how long it was, but it was a long, long time. I don't think it was quite 30 years, but again, you know, you want to go down my favorite subject. Horses don't run enough, take off too much time in between races, and it stinks that absolutely everybody wants to run three times a year. So, and this is what we get. But yeah, that is a good point, John. That's what it's come to. Nobody, not one horse of the 20 entered in the Kentucky Derby or the 19 that ran in the Kentucky Derby is going to make it through the entire series. That's just pitiful.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the future. I think if there's not going to be a triple crown on the line, I think that's we're going to see more and more of that in the future. I'm with John. I think that Known Agenda is interesting. He's a horse that I think is going to get better as the distances go longer. And that's kind of why I like Rocky World as well, even though, you know, people might dismiss him a little bit because he's a speed horse. Damn Sire's Empire Maker, who I remember won the Belmont. It's one of my first racing memories in that sloppy track beating Funny Side. I was heartbroken as a 16-year-old. But yeah, that's kind of why where I'm leaning is Rock Your World. It depends on the price. We'll see if he gets forgotten a little bit, but yeah, that's where I'm leaning. I agree with John that Known Agenda is a little bit sneaky as well. So that's the Belmont Stakes, where we'll wrap it all up next week. And it's going to be interesting to see, like I said, I think it'll be kind of a blanket, you know, close together finish. I don't think anybody's going to really stamp themselves as a new leader in the division, but you never know. And there'll be a lot to analyze and look forward to after that. So we'll break it all down next week. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. We'll be right back after this message from Legacy Bloodstock.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse. Every step of the way, when it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up and down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we are beyond excited this week to welcome racing legend, my favorite broadcaster of all time. We all miss you at the Naira, Tom Durkin. Thank you so much for coming on.
And Joe, who doubles as my agent. 10%. Keep up the good work. Right.
Hey, it probably pays better than what I make. But so we're great. We're super excited to have you on. And like I said, we all miss you. So I wonder, like, what's a day or a week in the life of Tom Durkin these days?
Breakfast, golf, lunch, nap, happy hour, rinse, repeat.
So that's basically like an off day at Saratoga.
Once the Saratoga meeting gets going, I'm pretty busy. I give tours at the racing museum every racing day, and do a lot of public speaking and what have you. I go to the track a couple days a week just to go to the track. I live right down the street, and so during the racing season, I'm pretty busy. And then I sit on a couple boards, horse racing boards. You mentioned Proven Strategies. And Proven Strategies is a horse owned by the members of the Empire Racing Club and Mr. Green and Partners. And so I do help out a little bit with that. I do a little what I call kissing hands and shaking babies for West Point Thoroughbreds and a little bit of this, a little bit of that. So I'm on the best board backstretch employee services team. And again, when the meeting starts, there's a lot of fundraisers in Saratoga. And I host a good number of those. So really busy during the meeting. Travel, go to North Carolina now, Pinehurst, North Carolina, in the winter to get out of the Northeast for a couple months. And other than that, you know, life is good.
Tom, welcome. And speaking of the Belmont Week, what is your finest memories of calling at Belmont, and what's your worst memories of calling at Belmont?
Well, I can tell you right off, the worst memory is getting up on Belmont Day and it's sunny. Now, the Belmont is run now almost at sunset. And Belmont Park is one of the very few buildings in the north that face north. The reason that Belmont faces north is because of the backyard. It was a historic mansion there when they built the place in 1905, and the guy collected trees from all over the world, and they wanted that to be the backyard where the paddock was going to be. So consequently, Belmont Park faces north. If it didn't face north, there probably wouldn't be aqueduct. You just can't run horse races at Belmont Park after October, basically. It's just too damn cold, and you can't run there during the winter at all. So anyway, so that being the case, so the track faces north. The sun sets in the west, and it's when the horses turn for home, they are backlit. They are mere shadows from the quarter pole to the 3/16 pole, almost the eighth pole. I mean, you're just looking at shadows that you cannot tell the difference between one horse colors and the rest. So you have to get a photographic image of those horses in your brain right before they make that turn into the stretch, because they do become invisible if the sun is up. It is a real bitch when that sun is and any other announcer that's been through it, it's you just don't you want cloud cover on Belmont Day. I guess my favorite one would have to be Real Quiet and Victory Gallop. That was an absolutely astonishing stretch run. At that time, no horse had won the Triple Crown, and I think at that time was 20 years. Yeah, 1998, 78 to 98, 20 years. And it didn't appear that, you know, anybody could do it. And Real Quiet's got a shot and turns for home. He's 5 in front. And here comes Victory Gallop, you know. And it was just as close a finish as ever. And the photo sign was up forever. And they slow-mowed the videotape down over and over and over. I think that photo sign was up for something like 8 or 9 minutes. You just couldn't tell. And every time they went by the finish line, the crowd would just go... there were a lot of people there, 60,000, 80,000, maybe, I don't know. And that was just, and Kent DeSormo rode Real Quiet. And at one point in the race, I said, and you have to choose your words very carefully, you know, when you're calling a race. And I said, he moved with 5 furlongs to go. And I said, he's moving early. Careful not to say he's moving too soon, but he is moving early. And to make your move 5/8 out is early, not necessarily too soon. So everybody goes, oh, I moved too soon, moved too soon. But if he wins by a millimeter, as opposed to losing by a millimeter, it would be not a bum ride, he moved too soon. It would have been the greatest timed move in racing history. So, just sweating out that photo was with the crowd, and it was thrilling, really. And then they had that inquiry, and afterwards the steward said, "Well, you know, we would have taken that horse down if it was the other way around." And yeah, sure, you're going to disqualify the crown.
And Tom, in preparation for our conversation, I know all of us watched, literally as many of your called races as we could. One of my personal favorites was the 2001 Breeders' Cup Classic, not only because it was at Belmont, but also because of the field that was in the race. I mean, you have Orientate, Galileo, Macho Uno, include Albert the Great and, of course, Tisnow, who ended up winning the race in the last couple of strides. And you just put together, you talked before about choosing your words carefully. You painted a picture for all of us going down the stretch of that race. And at the end, and we'll play the race so the viewers can hear it, but at the end you said, and Tisnow wins it for America. And that was right on the heels of 9/11 attack. What was going through your mind when you just painted the picture perfectly verbally about Tisnow winning it for America?
Tisnow fights on! Here's the wire! Desperately close! Tisnow wins it for America!
Yeah, I suppose some people might say that was a little jingoistic, but it was the story of the day. That day, I looked in the infield at the tote board area because there was something out there I'd never seen before. It's just like this green tarpaulin or something. I picked up my binoculars and it was a nest with guys on a SWAT team. And there were SWAT teams on the roof of Belmont Park. The security was, I remember when I went to work that day, one of the security guards was on the gate. And she said to me, I'm sorry, Tom, but I've got to see your ID, which I thought was a little kooky. But and again, that was 6 weeks after 9/11. And many people in that area, Belmont Park is part of it's located in Floral Park where I lived. And there were many, many people, firemen in particular, who lived in that neighborhood and who died in 9/11. So it was really brought things home pretty close. And they had a ceremony before the races started and a moment of silence. And, you know, that was the story of the day.
For sure.
It was the first international sporting event held in New York after 9/11.
Yeah, and that was, you know, you always had a flair for the dramatic. I think you were more of an artist than just a race caller.
I was a theater major, so
of course. There you go. Yeah, no. So you have the background, and you brought that to your job every day, and we all appreciated it. Seamless segue to a different kind of drama. Kind of racing has had these big scandals the last couple of years. And I wonder if your perspective on the sport and the kind of broader issues in the sport have changed from outside the announcer's booth now that you're involved as an owner, as an observer. Has your perspective on the sport changed at all?
Well, certainly, because A, I don't have to go to work. And I'm not, I you know, doing all that prep work was work, you know, and so now I'm just a weekend warrior. You know, I bet the horses on the weekend. I follow it, but not with the intensity that I used to. And we're in a state of flux. We're going to see how everything flushes out. You know, the Monmouth jockey situation is interesting, and we'll see how that works out with the whip restrictions that they have. That will play itself out one way or another. And my biggest worry about racing is the breed itself. That's the product. And I'm interested in the history of horse racing. You know, I'm certainly know a good deal about that being a tour guide at the museum. And you look at the past performances of these horses, not, you know, forever ago. You look at Forgo, you know, he's a foal in 1970 and he would run sometimes every 4 days. You know, the horses would run in New York. The New York schedule was the Swift, the Bayshore, the Gotham, and the Wood. They were all 2 weeks apart, and Wood was 2 weeks before the Kentucky Derby. Well, you know, that's not ever going to happen again. And the horses, I think, as a breed, are not what they were. I think it probably falls in the hands of commercial breeders, but that's just the way it is. And full fields is key to the game. And when these horses only start a handful of times a year, you're going to have short fields.
That's one of you teed up Bill for that one. That's one of Bill's pet peeves.
Yeah, I mean, Tom covered it well enough. Everybody knows I'm a broken record about how much I hate this kind of stuff. And just run the horses more often. Everything is fine, and fix the problems overnight. Understand that, Tom? Going back to the Belmont.
Just to go back on this one thing, and you and I, you had an idea that I had. I never vocalized it about horses not going to stud until they're five.
Right.
But it's not going to happen because those guys have, there's too much money involved.
Yeah, that was the rule that Jeff Grau put in harness racing, where if a horse was retired after the end of his three-year-old year, they weren't eligible to be a sire in that first year. Tom, just a simple question going back to the Belmont. I mean, you called everything from horses going to the Triple Crown Breeders' Cup, then down to a Thursday claiming race at Aqueduct, down to the Norbert County. You went to Norbert University, the Waukesha County Fair or something in Wisconsin. Did you, even after all that time, when you got to a situation with a real quiet and a victory gallop, were there butterflies? Were you nervous, or did it just, something? Yeah. Okay. Tell us about that.
Well, I gave up the NBC job because of stress caused by nerves. I just didn't want to put myself through that ringer anymore. It is nerve-wracking, believe me. And because 50 million people are going to listen to what you have to say, and if you make a mistake, goes on your gravestone. So the stress, I absolutely, it was a funny story. So when I gave up the network job of calling the Triple Crown, but still kept my job in New York because the stress like that was certainly stressful. Nothing like the stress of a big Triple Crown race. And so the New York Times wrote a story about it. They actually put it on the front page, not in sports, like front page of the newspaper. And the headline was "Stress Fells Triple Crown Announcer." And my friends, when they saw the paper, they go, "Oh my God, Tom Sturkin is dead!" And I read it. I was at a bar, surprise, at the time, and I read it. I go, "Does this look like I'm dead?" So yeah, the stress. Yeah, there's no getting around it. And I tried all sorts of stuff. Hypnosis, Inderol, which is a beta blocker with no side effects, and golfers take Inderol actually to get over the yips in their hands, over putts and stuff like that. So I even went to the extreme of dieting and exercising. That's how nice it was.
That's a commitment. That's a commitment to your craft for sure. For sure. Tom, one of the things that we take pride in when we're, buying horses and campaigning them is naming them. And, we personally put a lot of time into it. Are there certain names that you recall over the years that just stick out in your mind? Not even good horses, but just like fun names that it was fun to announce?
Well, there's Arg. And as you know, funny, the stuff that you learn, there's actually September 19th every year is National Talk Like a Pirate Day. Believe it or not, you can look it up. Yaki Hickamickadole, goofy names. He sells seashells. Just the goofy names. Usually it's the horse that ignobles the name,
Right. I personally remember one that you called where there was a horse that and her name was Harass. And you very eloquently said at the top of the stretch, she was up by 7 lengths. And you said at the top of the stretch, all you can see is Harass. And I thought it was I wish I could have named that horse. I was, but you nailed it. You nailed it.
I was also waiting for the day that they were going to, not let the horse run, so I could say, "Ladies and gentlemen, scratch her ass."
That's great. I also, the Do Re Mi Fa Sol La Ti Do, that was another viral hit.
Yeah, and you know what? The people that named that horse. They liked it, and so they named their next horse Volare. You know, it means it's that song. It means to fly in Italian. Volare. Oh. And they thought that, you know, I would sing Volare coming down the stretch. I'm not Frank Sinatra. It's, you know, we did Do, Re, Mi, Fa, Sol, La, Ti, Do. And that's the end of it, you know.
You set a high bar, though, with that note at the end of that horse. So I wouldn't blame that.
I did. I did it twice. And the second time I went off key because I had laryngitis.
this is what we love about Tom Durkin is you don't take yourself too seriously. You're willing to crack jokes and be self-effacing. Like, there are too many serious people in racing. The three of us, not amongst them, but there are a lot of serious people in racing. But before we let you go,
there's a lot to laugh at in me, trust me.
And in racing, too, to be honest.
That's true.
But before we let you go, we wanted to talk about the 2021 edition of the Champions Talk at Saratoga, which is a fundraiser for the Racetrack Chaplaincy of New York. It does great work with especially with backstretch families. So last year you guys did it, but obviously because of COVID, you couldn't have people in attendance this year. It is an in-person event. It's July 19th at 3 p.m. at the Facing Tipton's Saratoga location. And if you really want the unfiltered Tom Durkin, there's a cocktail reception that's going to be after the discussion. And we're going to put up a little graphic at the bottom here, rtcany.org is the website. But just talk a little bit about that and why you got involved.
Yeah, we did it last year. With Dale Romans was on the panel last year. And it's just, you know, sitting around telling stories is pretty much what it is. And we've got five jockeys. Migliori, Chris McCarron, Jorge Velasquez, Lafitte Pinkai Jr., Angel Cordero, and you know, these guys are just a font of information and stories. And we keep it light, we make it fun. They dig on each other a little bit. One of the topics I'm sure we'll get to is the 1978 Travers, featuring Affirmed and Ali Dar. Whatever meeting it was of theirs, maybe they're 10th or something like that. And Coffin had been the rider for Affirmed, and I believe he was sick, couldn't make it, and they got Lafitte Pinkai. And of course Jorge Velasquez rode Ali Dar. And so they're going into the far turn, and Pinkai tightens it up a little bit on Ali Dar and Velasquez, and took the number down. And there was a lot of screaming and yelling, whatever. East Coast favoritism. The stewards were all for the East Coast. They didn't want the West Coast guy to come out there and stuff like that. So we're going to have those two jockeys on the panel, Pinkai and Velasquez. And I'm sure the moderator will be sure to have them cover the topic thoroughly.
Stir the pot. You got to stir the pot. So Tom, thank you so much for coming back on. I actually might go up there just to see that, because I think that's going to be a blast. Last year's show was great, and like I said, the Racetrack Chaplaincy does great work. I'll splash up all the info at the bottom of the screen. Tom Durkin, we can't thank you enough for coming on. We wish we could have you on every week, honestly, because they're just a font of knowledge and great stories. Thanks so much for coming on, Tom.
Hey, invite me on. I got nothing better to do but
there are some weeks where we don't have a guest. We'll call you up.
I'll be like that. In the old days, the jocks room, they had a guy that would just sit around the jocks room for the last race when every once in a while a jock didn't want to ride the last race, and he was the house jock. So I can be your house guest.
That would be absolutely incredible. We do miss you in the booth, but we're glad you're still around racing. Tom, thanks again, man. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you all.
Thanks, Tom.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Tom Durkin will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust the Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit the Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
So once again, this is why we timestamp our podcast and let you know when we're actually recording it. This happened with the Justify scopolamine positive back in the day. It just broke in the last couple of minutes as we were wrapping up the show that Medina Spirit's post-race positive drug test was confirmed with the split sample. I was kind of wondering why this was taking so long, but now it's come in. It's in the New York Times and Joe Drape. Clark Brewster, who's the lawyer that represents Medina Spirit's owner, Imer Zidane, said the laboratory at the University of California, Davis confirmed that a second post-race sample found the drug betamethasone, which is a corticosteroid injected into joints to reduce pain and swelling at a prohibited level. Now, Brewster says that the laboratory did not test the blood or urine samples for the presence of other compounds, quote, which could prove the trace positive came from an inadvertent and materially inconsequential contamination sourced from a topical ointment used to treat Medina Spirit for a skin lesion on his hip. Now, maybe that's true, maybe it's not, but all I know is there's always an excuse for Bob Baffert when his horses test positive. And then we're going to have a lot more on this next week. Obviously, we don't know all the details yet or the consequences yet. Bill's probably got to run to go chase this story down. But we're obviously huge news. As soon as a DQ forthcoming in the Derby, and we assume I'm never going to see that money from Mandaloon, but that's beside the point. But this was, I think everybody expected this to happen. There's a lot to break down, and we're going to get to it next week in terms of the fallout. So yeah, we were unable to do the show about this, which is probably what we would have had the entire show about, but maybe it's a blessing in disguise because this has been a good show. But just Bill, any quick thoughts before you run and chase this story down?
Yeah, I know we don't want to exhaust this story, but a couple thoughts. First of all, here's what's going to happen next. It's a no-brainer. The lawyers for Baffert and Zidane are going to appeal. And they're going to take it now that it's been tried at the commission level, it goes into the court system. I don't think at the end of the day they will succeed, but they'll certainly delay any action by several months, if not a year or two type of thing. So we're going to have to live through this thing forever and ever and ever. And back to what Clark Brewster said, I think he's kind of missing an important point. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where it came from. It doesn't matter if somebody put a needle into the horse and injected him, or a groom's next door neighbor's daughter was using betamethasone and somehow it got into the system because it got it Baffert's head. It's there. It's not allowed to be there. Doesn't matter where and how it got there. And he's going to have to pay. Ultimately, if he loses in court, he'll ultimately have to pay the price. And Medina Spirit will be disqualified as the winner of the Kentucky Derby 2021.
This is why I love Bill Finley, because Bill Finley is a black or white guy. There is no in between when it comes to Bill Finley. And, you know, Bill, you are 1,000% correct. It doesn't matter how the horse got the drug. It's in his system.
Yep. Yeah. And then that's confirmed now. So there can be no more speculation about that. And the excuses, like I said, the era of excuses is over. That can all go by the wayside. Clark Brewster can say what he wants. Bob Baffert can say what he wants. At the end of the day, the Kentucky Derby winner tested positive twice for a banned substance and is going to get disqualified no matter how long they tie it up in the courts. And like I said, we're going to have lots more on this week. Just our luck that this broke as we're wrapping up the show. All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room, presented by the J.P. Morgan Private Bank, a proud sponsor of the Writers Room for over 200 years. They've helped successful individuals and families achieve their unique ambitions. And to learn more about them and explore becoming a client, visit privatebank.jpmorgan.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guest of the week, Tom Durkin, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Ritz, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for watching. We'll see you next week. We'll